Chapter 13. Skye slammed the cover down on the thick reference book she had been reading and shoved it across her desk to join a tall stack of similar, well-worn volumes. She hunched her shoulders and stretched her arms to work the kinks out of her muscles, and then leaned back in her chair, lips pursed, and stared at the helmet in front of her. She had always considered ancient weapons and armor simply as tools, nothing more than inanimate objects used in the bloody business of war. But this thing made her shiver. The oxidized black surface seemed to exude a malevolence she had never before encountered. After she had returned to Paris, Skye had taken the helmet to her office at the Sorbonne, expecting that identification would be easy with the reference tools at her command. She had photographed the helmet, fed the images into her computer, and searched through an extensive database compiled from hundreds of sources. She had started with her French archives, and then had moved on to Italy and Germany, the countries that were once the primary armor centers. Finding no match, she'd expanded the country search to take in all of Europe, and when that search had bottomed out, she moved to Asia and the rest of the world. She combed records going back as far as the Bronze Age. After the computer search fell flat, she turned to the printed page and exhumed every musty reference book in her library. She pored over old prints, manuscripts, and ivory and metal carvings. In desperation, she researched the Bayeux tapestry, but the conical headgear its warriors wore in battle bore no resemblance to the helmet sitting in front of her. The helmet was a contradiction. The workmanship was extraordinary and more characteristic of an ornamental than a war helmet, although the nicks and gouges marring the surface suggested that it could have been worn in battle. The apparent bullet hole was a puzzle all to itself. The design suggested an early origin. The weight was borne by the head, as in the earlier helmets. Later models had an armet, the flared bottom that allowed the weight to be transferred to the shoulders via a collar called a gorget. The helmet was topped with a fan-shaped crest, another later innovation that added protection from a mace or sword. Helmet style evolved from the conical shape in the 11th century to rounded helms in the 12th century. The nose guards had expanded to protect the face, developing eye slits known as sights, and ventilation openings called breaths came into being. German helmets tended to be heavy and spiky. The Italian models were rounder, reflecting the Renaissance influence. The most extraordinary thing about this helmet was the metal. Steel manufacture had started as early as 800 BC, but it took hundreds of years to develop metal of such high quality. Whoever had forged this metal was a master. The strength built into this helmet's steel was evident in the dent in the crown known as a proof mark. Someone had tested the metal with a pistol or arquebus, and it had proved itself impenetrable. But as the bullet hole showed, each rise in the efficiency of defense produced a corresponding response in the effectiveness of attack. Armor finally became obsolete in the 1522 Battle of Bicocca. The enemy was gravity rather than projectiles. Armor simply became too heavy to wear. The face embossed on the visor was typical of 16th century Italian armor. Artisans avoided embossing in combat helmets. Surface features had to be smooth and round or shaped with planes to offer a glancing blow. Embossing could destroy the effectiveness of a glancing surface. She picked up her letter opener, actually an Italian dagger, and tried to catch the edge and point in the helmet. Despite the embossing and etching that covered the helmet, the metal had been cleverly fashioned to shed the blows. She came back to the steel again. No detail distinguished one armorer from another more than his ability to temper metal. She wrapped her knuckles on the helmet, which gave forth a clear, bell-like sound, and then with her forefinger she traced a five-point star with legs. She turned the helmet around. Seen from another angle, the etching depicted a shooting star. She recalled seeing a sword from an English collection that had been made with iron from a meteorite. The steel was capable of being sharpened to a razor's edge. Why not a helmet? She made a note to have a metallurgist check it out. Skye rubbed her tired eyes, and with a resigned sigh, she reached for the phone and punched out a number. A man's voice came on the line. It was deep and pleasantly cultivated.
Oui, darne antiquité.
Jean, it's Skye LaBelle. Ah, Skye. Darnay was clearly glad to hear her voice. How are you, my dear? How is your work going? Is it true that you were in the Alps? Yes, that's why I'm calling. I came across an old helmet during my expedition. It's quite extraordinary, and I'd like you to look at it. It has me stumped. What about your wonderful computer? Darnay teased. Darnay and Skye had had friendly arguments over the technological tools she used. He felt empirical experience gained through constant handling of artifacts was more valuable than browsing any database. She countered that the computer saved her valuable time. Nothing is wrong with my computer, she said with mock indignation. I've looked through every book in my library as well. I can't find an exact match. I'm very surprised. Darnay was acquainted with Skye's reference library and knew it was one of the best he had ever seen. Well, I'd love to look at it. Come over now if you'd like. Bien, I'll be right along. She wrapped the helmet in a pillowcase, then put it in a shopping bag from Au Printemps and headed out for the nearest metro station. Darnay's shop was on the right bank, down a narrow street next to a boulangerie that sent out mouth-watering aromas of baking bread. Printed in small gilt letters on the shop's door was the word Antiquities. In the window was an odd and dust-covered assortment of powder horns, flintlock pistols, and a few rusty swords. It was not a display that would entice anyone into the shop, which was Darnay's intention. The doorbell tinkled as she entered the shop. The dingy interior was dark and narrow and empty except for a rusty suit of armor and some fly-specked cabinets holding a few poor replicas of antique daggers. A velvet curtain at the rear of the shop parted, and a wiry man dressed in black emerged from the widening ribbon of light. He cast a furtive glance at Skye, brushed by as silently as a shadow, and left the shop, quietly shutting the door behind him. Another man stepped out of the back room. He was short and in his 70s and resembled the old film actor Claude Rains. He was impeccably attired in a dark blue suit and stylish red silk tie, but would have projected an air of elegance if he had been in a workman's smock. His dark eyes sparkled with intelligence. His hair and thin mustache were silver gray, and he was smoking a Galoise in a cigarette holder, which he removed from his lips so he could kiss Skye on both cheeks. "That was fast," he said with a smile. "This helmet of yours must be a very important find." She returned the kisses. "That's for you to tell me. Who's that man who just left?"
"He is one of my, suppliers."
"He looks like a sneak thief." An alarmed expression crossed Darnay's face. Then he laughed.
"Of course. That's what he is."
Darnay flipped the sign on his door to closed and then led her past the curtain to his office. In stark contrast to the worn-at-the-heels seediness of his showroom, the office workshop was well lit by track lights, and the desk and workspace were of contemporary design. The walls were hung with weapons, but most of them were inferior items that he sold to less knowledgeable collectors. His top-grade inventory he kept safe in a warehouse. Although he teased Skye about her reliance on technology, he did business mostly through the internet and a glossy catalog mailed to an exclusive list of buyers that was hungrily awaited by dealers and collectors worldwide. Skye had first sought Darnay out for advice in spotting forgeries. She soon learned that his knowledge of old arms and armor surpassed that of some academics, including herself. They had become good friends, although it became apparent that he dealt in the shadowy world of illegal antiquities. In short, he was a crook, but a classy one.
"Let's see what you have, my dear."
He pointed to a brightly lit table that was used to photograph objects for the catalog. Skye removed the helmet from the bag and set it on the table, then pulled off the pillowcase with a flourish. Darnay gazed with reverence at the object. Then he walked around the table, puffing on his cigarette, bending low, with his face inches from the metal. After going through the dip-and-stand routine, he picked the helmet up, hefted the weight, held it high, and then put it on his head. Wearing the helmet, he walked over to a cabinet and pulled out a bottle of Grand Marnier.
"Brandy?" he offered.
Skye laughed at the sight and shook her head. Well, what do you think?
Extraordinaire. He put the helmet back on the table and poured himself a brandy. Where did you get this lovely objet d'art?
It was frozen into the Le Dormieux glacier.
A glacier? Even more extraordinary.
That's not half the story.
It was found near a body that was embedded in the ice. The body may have been in the glacier less than 100 years. The man probably parachuted from a plane whose wreckage was found in the nearby lake.
Darnay poked his forefinger through the hole in the helmet.
And this?
I think it's a bullet hole.
The antiquities dealer didn't seem surprised. Then this Iceman could have been wearing the helmet?
Possibly.
It's not a failed proof mark.
I don't think so. Look at the hardness of that steel.
Musket balls would have bounced off the metal like peas. The hole was made by a more modern firearm. So we have a man flying over a glacier wearing an old helmet, shot with modern weapons.
She shrugged.
It seems so. Darnay sipped his brandy. Fascinating. But it all makes little sense.
Nothing about this whole affair makes sense.
She settled into a chair and told Darnay about Renault's summons to the cave and her harrowing rescue. Darnay listened with furrowed brow.
Thank God you're safe.
This Kurt Austin is an homme formidable. Handsome too, I suppose?
Very much so.
She felt herself blushing. I owe him my gratitude. I have always thought of you as a daughter, Skye. I would have been devastated if anything had happened to you.
Well, nothing did, thanks to Mr. Austin and his colleague, Joe Zavala.
She gestured at the helmet.
Well?
I believe it's older than it looks. As you say, the steel metal is extraordinary. The metal used in its manufacture may very well have been forged in the stars. The fact that this is the only one of its kind that I have ever seen, and that you found no reference to it in your library, leads me to think it might have been a prototype.
If the features were so innovative, why weren't these ideas picked up sooner?
You know the nature of arms and men. Good sense does not always prevail over intransigence. The Polish cavalry insisted on using horse cavalry against armored panzer divisions. Billy Mitchell had an uphill fight convincing the army hierarchy of the value of aerial bombardment. Maybe someone looked at this and said the old equipment was preferable to the untested.
Any thoughts on the armorer's mark or the coat of arms I saw here and on the plane?
Yes, but none of them are scientific.
I'd be interested to hear them anyhow, and perhaps I'll take that offer of brandy.
Darnay poured another snifter, and they tapped glasses. I'd say the eagle represents the joining together, an alliance of some sort, of three different groups into one. E pluribus unum, one out of many. It was not an easy arrangement. The eagle seems to be pulling itself apart, yet it must hang together or die. The arms it is clutching in its claws would lead me to believe that this alliance has something to do with war.
Not bad for an unscientific guess.
He smiled. If we only knew who your Iceman was.
He glanced at his watch.
Excuse me, Skye, but I have a conference call with a dealer in London and a buyer in the United States. Would you mind if I kept this piece here for a few hours so I could study it further?
Not at all. Just call when you want me to pick it up. I'll either be at my office or my apartment.
A cloud passed over his brow. My dear girl, there is more here than meets the eye. Someone was willing to kill for this artifact. It must have great value. We must be very careful. Does anyone know you have it?
Kurt Austin, the Numa man I told you about. He's trustworthy.
Some of those who were in the cave would know of it.
And Renault?
Renault, he said, drawing out the name. That's not good. He'll want it back.
Her dark eyes snapped with anger. Over my dead body. She smiled nervously, realizing the implication of her words.
I can stall him. Say the helmet is at the metallurgist.
Darnay's phone rang.
That is my call. We'll talk later.
After leaving the shop, she went to her apartment instead of her office. She wanted to check her message machine, hoping she would hear from Austin. Her discussion with Darnay had given her the jitters. She had the feeling that danger was lurking nearby, and hearing Austin's voice would have offered some reassurance. When she got home, she played her messages, but there was no word from Kurt. She felt weary from her work. She lay down on the sofa with a copy of a fashion magazine, intending to relax before going back to the office. But after a few minutes, the magazine fell from her fingers to the floor, and she drifted off into a deep sleep. Skye would have slept less soundly if she knew what Auguste Renault was up to. He sat in his office in a dangerous fury, head bent over his desk, compiling a list of complaints against Skye LaBelle. His hand was mending, but his pride was still gravely wounded. All his ill will centered on that insolent woman. He would pull every political string at his command, call in every IOU owed him to destroy her, ruin her career and that of anyone who had been even vaguely friendly to her. She had humiliated him in front of others and ignored his authority. He would have her thrown out of the Sorbonne. She'd beg for mercy. He pictured himself as the creator in one of those Renaissance paintings of God, chasing Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden with his flaming sword. He had encountered her in the elevator that morning. She had said good morning and smiled at him, sending him off into a simmering rage. He had his anger under control by the time he got to his office and was directing it to the list of complaints he had in front of him. He was writing a detailed description of her loose morals when he heard a soft shuffle. The chair creaked in front of his desk. He assumed it was his assistant. Head still bent to his work, he said, "Yes." When no one answered, he looked up, and his bowels turned to ice water. The chair had been turned around. Sitting in it was the big, puffy-faced man who had attacked him under the glacier. Renault was adept at survival. He pretended that he hadn't recognized his visitor. He cleared his throat.
"How can I help you?" he said.
"You don't know me."
"I don't believe so. Do you have business with the university?"
"No, I have business with you." Renault's heart sank.
"I'm sure you must be mistaken."
"You were on television," the man said. Even before Renault had arrived back in Paris, he had called a favored television reporter and arranged an interview in which he took complete credit for finding the Iceman and suggested that he was responsible for the rescue as well.
"Yes. You saw the interview.
You told the reporter that you found objects under the glacier. The box was one object. What were the others?"
"There was only one. A helmet. Apparently, it was very old."
"Where is the helmet now?"
"I thought it was left in the cave, but a woman smuggled it out."
"Who is this woman?" A malicious gleam came to Renault's eye. Maybe this cretin would leave him alone if he had a more tempting target. He could get rid of him and Skye at the same time.
"Her name is Skye LaBelle. She's an archaeologist. Do you want her name and number?"
He reached for the faculty directory and opened it. "She has an office on the floor below this one. The number is 216. Anything you do to her is all right with me." He tried to hide his joy. He'd give almost anything to see Skye's face when this madman arrived at her doorstep. The man slowly stood up.
Good. He was leaving. "Is there anything else you want?" Renault said with a magnanimous smile.
The big man smiled slowly in return. From under his coat, he drew a .22-caliber pistol that had a silencer attached to the barrel. "Yes," he said, "I want you to die." The gun coughed once. A round red hole appeared in Renault's forehead. He fell forward onto his desk, his smile frozen on his face. The big man picked up the open directory, tucked it in his pocket, and without looking back at the lifeless body slumped over the desk, he left the office as silently as he had entered.